Let's get stuck now into our Asia update. In this edition, Central Asia, a part of the world that's become, well, a bit of a geopolitical hotspot recently. And here to guide us is Bruce Pannier. Bruce is a long-time journalist and correspondent covering Central Asia. He writes the Central Asia in Focus newsletter for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and he also hosts their Marge Lee's podcast. Now, Bruce, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Can we start with, we're going to look at the stands. Let's start with Kazakhstan. I understand people are disappointed with the outcome of the country's recent parliamentary elections.
Oh, yes. Well, first, let me thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, indeed, Kazakhstan just did hold elections to the lower house of parliament. Now, for the last year, a little bit more than a year, the president of the country has been promising that there are political reforms coming to the country. And they amended the constitution. They held new presidential elections. And so this was the last set of elections they were holding. And this was supposed to show progress on the path of democracy. To the government, what that meant was that not only people from political parties could run, but also independent candidates. There are no registered opposition parties in the country. So it raised hopes that some of these independent candidates would be elected and that they would speak, they would be the voice of the people, so to speak. Now, in the end, the elections were held. None of the independent candidates were elected. All the people that were elected came from the established political parties that are all pro-presidential. And so it was kind of a failed experiment.
So bloody protests were made.
Yeah, that was at the start of 2022 in January. And that's actually what led up to all these great promises of democratic reforms, because those are nationwide protests calling for all kinds of changes in the government. But one basic theme throughout it was the call that people wanted more say in how the government was run. They wanted an end to the nepotism and corruption that characterized the Kazakh government. They wanted their voices to be heard, someone to speak up for them in the government so that they would get socioeconomic changes too that everyone's been calling for. So, you know, like I said, they've been promised this for more than a year, and in the end, the elections look almost no different than any election they've held in the last 25 years.
But it may inspire more unrest.
You know, that's the big worry, is that this is going to leave people so disappointed after all these, you know, listening to all these pledges and vows about we're going to change this, we're going to change that, we're going to create a new Kazakhstan, a second republic. And it looks exactly like it did. So this already, you know, raises the possibility that what we saw in January 2022 could be repeated. And we've already seen, besides the protests against the conduct of elections, there are labor protests that are gaining speed in the western part of the country, which is the oil region of Kazakhstan. And that's really how the nationwide protests in January 2022 started, was over protests among oil workers, specifically protesting the rise in price of automobile fuel.
The voice of Bruce Pannier. There's also a Taliban delegation about the place.
Yeah, this is one of the strangest developments in recent days. There is a Taliban delegation in a remote area of Tajikistan. Now, why is that strange? Because Tajikistan is the most hostile government to the Taliban in all of Central Asia. All the other Central Asian governments in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan have established a dialogue with the Taliban and not recognition. No one recognizes that government, but they've at least established a dialogue and talked to them, whereas Tajikistan has refused to do that. So the sudden appearance of a Taliban delegation ostensibly there to inspect damage to a consulate building, again, in a remote area of eastern Tajikistan, just seems very strange. The old Afghan ambassador from the Ghani government is still occupying the embassy in the Tajik capital. So why are the Taliban in this remote city in the east inspecting a consulate to see if there was damage from a recent avalanche? It's a very strange story, which really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Bruce, more broadly, what has the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan meant for Central Asian countries?
Well, obviously, they were very disappointed with this. The Central Asian governments all played some role in the operations of foreign forces in Afghanistan. Transit points, they used some of the U.S. had a base that they used in Kyrgyzstan. NATO had a base they used in Tajikistan. The U.S. had a base that it used in Uzbekistan, and so did Germany. So the Central Asian governments were kind of counting on the fact that this would be the end of the Taliban. They were very afraid of them when they showed up in the 1990s, did everything they could to try to get them out, but were unsuccessful. So they were happy when the foreign forces drove them out post 9/11, disappointed when the Taliban returned to power after foreign forces all withdrew. But because of infrastructure improvements like the power transmission cables from Tajikistan, but also roads, railways, things like that. There's a new possibility for doing trade, not so much with Afghanistan, but through Afghanistan. And that's what a lot of the Central Asian governments, certainly the Uzbek government, are interested in, is that there are routes and potential future routes that could connect them with Pakistan and India and open up a whole new trade network. And of course, if they can get through goods through to Pakistan, they can get to the Arabian Sea and into the Indian Ocean and trade with the Middle East and Eastern Africa too, and even parts of Asia. So this is the real incentive for the Central Asian governments to maintain a dialogue with the Taliban, is they're hoping that the Taliban at least get stability in the country and that they can use that stability to further expand trade networks going through the country and obviously enrich themselves by trade from southern countries.
Bruce, let's factor in the war in Ukraine. That must have profound effects on Central Asian countries who, I guess, are having to walk that diplomatic tightrope.
Oh, absolutely. This is a great point because, because Russia's war is seen as imperialist, again, neo-imperialism on Russia's part. They're trying to recreate some Russian empire, and Russian officials have even said, made comments about historic Russian lands. President Putin even said that he regards all the territory of the former Soviet Union as being historic Russian lands. Now, Central Asia was part of the Tsarist Empire and, of course, part of the Soviet Union, too. When they hear comments like that, they look in the mirror that's Ukraine, and then they see themselves in the future as possibly being taken over by Russia. Kazakhstan, which we talked about at the start of this, is the most affected. Clearly, it has a 7,800 kilometer long border with Russia. There have been Russian officials who have specifically called out Kazakhstan and saying that northern Kazakhstan, no one was living there when the Russians showed up. They're the ones that settled it, built everything up there, and really by rights that should belong to Russia.
It's interesting, isn't it, that both Russia and the Western countries want Central Asia support. And, of course, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken was in the region last month in an effort to shore up ties.
Yeah, he wants to voice support for sovereignty and territorial integrity. He didn't have much to offer. To be absolutely honest, there's no way that Central Asia could cut all its ties with Russia. Those have been established over the course of two centuries. So it would be impossible to envision a future for Central Asia that did not involve Russia to a large extent, too. But the U.S. is trying to get them to be more independent. And so are the allies in Western Europe, too, and across Europe. They want the Central Asians to be able to stand on their own two feet and not be dependent on Russia and not be dependent upon China. So they're trying to help them to expand their own trade networks, the ones that go to Europe, certainly. But also I've mentioned that they're trying to get them to expand networks going south to the Middle East and other places, too, so that Russia is still an important partner, but not a crucial partner as it is today.
I learned from you that 8 million Central Asian citizens work in Russia.
Yeah, Russia has a big labor shortage, which is growing, as you can imagine, right now as they keep running these conscriptions in the country and mobilization. So they've always needed extra manpower. And the jobs that are available in Russia, although it's blue-collar, menial labor, doesn't pay a whole lot, it still is better than what's on offer at home. Unemployment is, everyone says in Central Asia, all the governments try to keep these low figures single digit, but everyone knows it's more like 20-30%, could even be higher in some of these places. So a lot of people are attracted by the fact that there is constant source of income in Russia. There's the possibility of getting Russian citizenship, and you would think that that was not too attractive, but actually, you know, the benefits and the pay are better than in Central Asia. So a lot of people still go, even though the young men obviously risk being conscripted into the Russian military and sent to Ukraine, and many have been already, but it's still an attractive destination, and it's easy to get into. You know, the Central Asians need all kinds of visas and things to get into Europe, to get into places like Japan or South Korea, which are also places they want to go. But Russian, it's very easy for them to get visas and work permits to go and work in Russia, and that's why you end up with 8 million of them there.
We recently talked on the program about China's growing influence in the Middle East, effectively sidelining America. It's a similar story in Central Asia, is it not?
Absolutely. You know, China has started this process in the mid-1990s when they formed what was then the Shanghai Five and is now called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It was supposed to be just mutual competence building measures along the Chinese border with what was the former Soviet Union, but Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and Russia. They expanded that into an economic cooperation organization too. And through using that, they have, as a vehicle, they've managed to firmly cement themselves into Central Asia. China has paid for so many of the big projects that are now functioning in Central Asia, and more that are coming. They're a source of money that nobody else has been able to put forward. So that they have been willing to spend billions of dollars in some cases, but hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases, which no other country or company will invest in Central Asia to build these kind of projects, which the Central Asians need: roads, railways, power stations, the list goes on and on. So China has been constant with that. There was the global economic crisis in 2008, didn't affect China, didn't affect Chinese investment. More recently, the drop in oil prices in 2014, 2015. Again, China was solid partner there again. Now there's the crisis over Russia's war on Ukraine, and China is still the same solid partner. So they've managed to really entrench themselves into Central Asia, and to the point where the Central Asian governments really probably would face huge economic problems if they could not depend on China, which is exactly what China wants, of course. They have Western neighbors, Muslim countries, whose loyalty they bought off through their investments and loans.
How did the recent meeting between Xi and Putin go down in Central Asia?
Well, they played it pretty much straight up in the news. I don't think any of the Central Asians are under any illusions that this is a equal partnership. They have to deal with China themselves, and they understand China is the senior partner. So when they see the situation in Russia, when they see Xi and Putin meeting together, I think they understand that Russia is the junior partner in this relationship again, and more dependent upon China in the way that Central Asia has grown to be dependent upon China too. China can resist international pressure, but at the same time, it's a source of funding. And that's pretty much what Russia is depending on for China, too. That's where the partnership is for Russia. It helps them fend off international criticism, and it's a potential source of exports from Russia to fill the gaps that are being left as Europe has sanctioned them, and for future projects, too. I mean, you can see that Russia has shifted its economic focus from the West to the East and as much as possible in the last year.
Bruce, thanks for that. Bruce Pannier, journalist and correspondent, covering, yes, Central Asia.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.